At every meeting that we've all attended, there's a gal or a guy comes to share their experience, strength, and hope, or to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I've never had the pleasure of hearing Cease before. Ain't too crazy about him because he got better jokes than me. But when he's finished today, I'll have better jokes than him because I'm going to be using his jokes. But I've heard a lot of nice things about him. He's a great worker in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's here for one reason, to carry the message to the alcoholic. Let's meet and greet Cease from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan.
Good luck and God bless you, friend.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. After listening to all of the beautiful speakers and panels, and the chairman today, I feel a little bit like Elizabeth Taylor's next husband's going to feel like. I know what's expected of me, but I don't know how to make it interesting anymore. Friday night started out pretty great with a Catholic. Saturday afternoon with a beautiful Jewish girl from Mississippi. Last night with a Baptist minister. And this afternoon, I tell you, there's a real treat. Because I'm an Anglican that joined the Presbyterian Church. Because I'm in the fur business, everybody thinks I'm Jewish. And I suffer from a Catholic disease. Speaking of Catholics, that's the reason I'm here. I grew up in a Catholic community, the only Protestant that lived there. And I grew up hating Catholics. You would, too, if you'd lived there. They used to call the bingos in Latin, so I couldn't understand them. The other day that the Pope called all the cardinals around and he says, I got some good news and some bad news. He says, first of all, for the good news, I just had a phone call from our Lord and he's on his way back. One of the cardinals says, well, what's the bad news? And the Pope says, he phoned from Salt Lake City. Isn't Alcoholics Anonymous beautiful? The whole three of them, they spoke to you and they talked about the ability to listen. I get up to speak and two of them are going to the plane and Peter's driving them. My name is Cease Corrigal and I'm from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be here. As a matter of fact, I'm grateful to be anywhere. Because of this beautiful program, because of people like you, because of a loving God, as I understand him, I haven't had to have a drink since January the 16th, 1952. for this, I'm very grateful. And I didn't just waken up one morning and decide what should I do today. I think I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't that way. But I'm not going to tell you about my drinking story because I don't think it would serve any purpose. But I can tell you one thing, that I'm not here by mistake. I'm qualified to be here. And I don't think that it would serve a great purpose. Something like the story of the circus that was going through this small town. And the elephant strolled away from the circus. And it strolled into a sweet old lady's backyard and it got in her cabbage patch. And she'd never seen an elephant before. And she phoned up the chief of the police in this small town. And she said, there's a strange animal in the backyard. Huge thing. About the size of 4 or 5 horses. Strange looking animal. Has a tail on both ends. And the old chief of police wanted to say something intelligent, like most chiefs of police. He said, well, what is this strange animal doing to your cabbage? And she says, you wouldn't believe it if I told you. It'll take a little while for some of you. And that's something like my story. You wouldn't believe it if I told you. But for the benefit of the young ones, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 27 years of age. And I came here because I had drank too much, and I'd caused a lot of heartache to a lot of people, including myself. And the last 2 years that I drank, I was an arrogant drunk the last couple of years, and I had a lot of fights. Because when I drank, I thought I had muscle. And big people started to look very small to me whenever I was drunk. And that's the reason that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. One night in my town, I was in a poker game. And a great big fellow that weighed 275 pounds, an ex-commando. And he was a little narrow about something I did in a poker game. And he stood up, and I thought he weighed about 118. And I stood up, and he hit me, and I hit the cement. And he hit me, and I hit the cement. And we did this about 10 times, and finally, I stayed down, not because I wanted to, but because I couldn't get up. And to show you how well I was thought of in my hometown at that time, it was at a hockey stag, and the people just left me lying in the cement and walked right over me. And I woke up the next day in that hotel, and I went to hospital. I didn't go to hospital because I was a drunk. I went to hospital because some big guy beat up on me. In a couple of days, 5 days, as a matter of fact, after I'd been in hospital, my doctor came and sat down beside my bed. And he said, Cease, I can't do anything for you. I built you up physically. Fortunately for me, this doctor had been in the army with me. And he said, you were bad in the army as far as drink is concerned. And things have gotten worse since you got home. And I think you're an alcoholic. So I said, well, what should I do? And he said, well, I would suggest that you join Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't leave it at that. He went out and he brought Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And they came to see me. And I'll never forget that day. Because they came into that room, and I'll never forget the two guys that came to see me. One of them was the sloppiest drunk in all of Canada. And all of a sudden he's in my room, and he's dressed up, and he's clean, and his hair is combed, and he's looking good, and he's smiling. And I knew that something had happened to him. The other fellow was a chap that I'd been in the service with, and he was from Prince Albert, and when he came back, he was over in Edmonton. And he got in trouble over there with the law, and he got 5 years in our penitentiary for robbery with violence. And he found Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary. And he, too, looked good. And he, too, didn't have to say anything because I knew that something had happened to him. Bill is sober today in Welland, Ontario. Earl died a couple of years ago drunk. He fell in our Saskatchewan River and died. But the thing is, he helped do what he was supposed to do. He planted the seed of Alcoholics Anonymous with me. And I got out of that hospital on a Saturday morning, and I had a difficult time getting out because I had a private ward when I was in there, and it's before the days of Saskatchewan Medicare, and I'd given a bad check to get a private room. And because I was Protestant and because there's a Catholic hospital, they were a little narrow about those things. And that little Catholic sister wouldn't let me out until such time as I paid off my bad check. And I phoned the only person that I knew my credit was any good with. And that was my bootlegger. And he came and bailed me out of hospital. Probably had he known what I was going to do, he'd have left me there. Because I haven't had to give him any business, although he's still in business, since that day. And I didn't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't think that I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I just had a little bad luck. And I didn't go want to, join a bunch of bums. And that's what I thought of you. But Bill and Earl said that they would pick Babe and I up and take us to the meeting on Saturday night. And they picked us up. And it is the last place in the world that I wanted to go. I was something like the three alcoholic rabbits. I don't know whether you've ever seen an alcoholic rabbit or not. I don't mean an ordinary Saturday night drunk. I mean a real, genuine alcoholic rabbit. And there were three of them. One was called Foot, and the other was Foot, Foot, and the other was Foot, Foot, Foot. And Foot, Foot, Foot used to phone up Foot, Foot, and he'd say, let's pick up old Foot, and we'll go down to the bar. So Foot, Foot, and Foot, Foot, Foot would pick up Foot, and they'd get down to the bar. One night, Foot, 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 and Foot, Foot were sitting talking, and Foot, Foot said to Foot, 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 he said, where's Foot? Foot, Foot, Foot said to Foot, Foot, well, Foot was here just a minute ago, but he went outside. So Foot, Foot, and Foot, Foot, Foot went outside to look for Foot. And they found poor old Foot, and Foot had died. And Foot, Foot said to Foot, 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 what do you think we should do with Foot? And Foot, Foot, Foot said to Foot, Foot, well, I think we should take him down to the funeral home. After the funeral, Foot, Foot, Foot said to Foot, Foot, he said, what do you think Foot died from? And Foot, Foot said to Foot, 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 he said, well, he was drinking quite a bit. And Foot, Foot, Foot said to Foot, Foot, he said, do you think we're drinking too much? And Foot, Foot said to Foot, 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 he said, I think we are. So Foot, Foot, Foot said to Foot, Foot, he said, do you think we should join Alcoholics Anonymous? And Foot, Foot said to Foot, 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 might as well. We got one foot in the grave anyway. And that's what I thought about you people. I thought you had to have one foot in the grave. But I went to that beautiful meeting, and it was a fantastic thing. There weren't too many there. It was a Saturday night. First of all, they had a social. Wasn't my idea of spending a Saturday night, but it was quite a deal. I didn't think that they were all sober because they did some stupid things. They played games like pin the tail on a donkey. This really wasn't my idea of a Saturday night. And I sniffed a few of them because I thought they must be drinking. After the social was over, they had a meeting. And I can remember one guy at that time standing up to say he'd been sober for a year. And I sat in the back with my big negative attitude and I said to myself, liar. Couldn't be much of a drunk if you can stay sober for a year. And I knew him. He was a traveling man. I knew he used to go out on the road. And I thought, well, he probably drinks out on the road and comes back in and tells his yahoos that he hasn't drank. After the meeting, a couple of the old-timers had been sober for about a year and a half. And they took me in another room. And they said, Cease, we want to tell you something. There's no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous, so they tell us. But they said, there's a meeting here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and you must be here. And I'm glad they talked to me like that, because I haven't stopped going. I'm still going to those meetings. Because they told me I must be there. And I think that this is so necessary that we tell the newcomer the truth. You know, some of us sort of pussyfoot around. I'm glad they talked to me like that because that's the only language that I understood. I was something like the guy that worked in this big plant. There were 300 people worked there. They promised them a all prepaid insurance policy if everybody would join. 299 people joined. The 300th guy said, no, I don't believe in insurance. The shop foreman went down to talk to him. He said, no, I don't want any insurance. The assistant manager of the plant went down and talked to him. He said, no, I don't want any insurance. President of the union went down to see him. He said, no, I don't want any insurance. I don't believe in it. I'll probably get killed. I'll probably die. My wife will get all the money. Marry somebody else. They live happily ever after. I want no part of that. Manager of the plant went down and he said, look it, buddy. 2 seconds after I finished telling you about this, if you haven't signed, he said, you will go through that door and I won't open it. I'll just throw you through it. The guy took the paper and signed it. Manager of the plant went up, threw it to the other three guys. The other three guys rushed down to the guy and they said, how come you signed it for him and you wouldn't sign it for us? And he said, nobody ever explained it that clearly before. So you see, I think it's important that we explain things clearly to people. Tell them what it's all about. And I think we can save their lives that way. Whether they're in Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell them what it's all about. Tell them what they have to do. And I had a great time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you I was 27 years of age. At that time, I was the youngest member in the group. I was in the youngest member in all of Saskatchewan. And it was great. People were patting me on the back, and I found exactly what I was looking for all of my life. For people to want me and like me. And it was just beautiful. And then a horrible thing happened. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me. And they went and talked to the older members. And the older members went by me and they talked to the newer members. And I stood out there and all of a sudden I'm a middle member. And I tell this to you because this may happen to you. Whether you're in Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, this can happen. I felt like a hole in a donut. I was nothing. And I thought, well, maybe I should go out and have a few smacks at her again and come back in and get that same treatment. But then a great thing happened. We had a fellow in our group at that time by the name of Ernie Sear. Ernie's now died, but he was a great little guy. And we asked Ernie to chair our meetings, and we have discussion meetings in our group. And Ernie said, well, I'll chair the meeting, providing we do one thing. And we said, what's that? And he said, well, we are going to start at step one as a group. And we are going to go through the steps as a group. We're not going to talk about them, we're going to do them. And he said, I don't care if John Diefenbaker comes into Alcoholics Anonymous. And John's big in my town, I want you to know. He said, we're not going back to step one. And so we thought we'd humor old Ernie, and we went along with it. And that's the experience that I'm going to share with you this afternoon. The experience that I had through these beautiful steps. And I'm not going to tell any one of you people how you should do it. I am going to share the experience that I had through these beautiful 12 steps. And I took a look at step one with the rest of the group. Where it says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I found out that there were two parts to step one. I found out that I had an unmanageable life. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous owing $6,200. Now, I know that's not a lot of money in Ontario. But in 1952, that was a lot of money in Saskatchewan. And if you put it into inflationary terms, it's probably about $20,000. And I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it. I told you I came here by way of a poker game. And I owed it to some strange people. And I was working for a great guy, probably the wealthiest man in my city. And he got sick and tired of listening to people phone me and phone him about the money I owed. And he took me to the bank. And I can remember yet what that bank manager told him. This guy that took me to the bank that owned the business I was working for had a lot of money. He practically owns the city of Prince Albert. And you know what that bank manager told him? He said, Alec, even with you endorsing his note, I wouldn't give him that money. Isn't that cruel? But I think Alec threatened to buy the bank and fire him. And I got the money. And he had Babe and I sign a paper that we would never charge anything again. We'd pay cash for everything. 3 years later, he bailed me out for $7,500. For you see, I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. And I know none of you people have got that problem. But I'm telling you about me. And this is not while I'm drinking. This is in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a problem with money in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found out that financial problems have nothing to do with money. That's a strange one, isn't it? It had a lot to do with big shotism. It had a lot to do with pride. It had a lot to do with ego. And I know that's nothing to do with you people. But I'm talking about me. And I had a terrible time as far as this money is concerned. But to show you that I've changed just a little bit. Not too many years ago, I owed a manufacturer $10,000. That's not a lot of money in my business because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money in the middle of July when it's about 97 above. And this fellow was writing me some strange letters, and he was saying things like padlocks on doors and sheriffs and things like that. And I thought I'd better write him a letter. And I wrote him a beautiful letter. And I told him I liked his merchandise, and I'd sold some on a layaway plan, and I had small deposits, and that I'd like fall dating. And then I threw a little philosophy at him. I said if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it would seem like a long ways. It would even seem like a longer ways if I took it a telephone pole at a time. But that I'd finally get there. I signed it, yours truly, Cecil E. Corgle, manager of the Cecil Corgle Fur Clinic, P.S. I am enclosing a certified check for $100. And I sent it away. A couple of days later, this is when the mail was still going through in record time. I got a letter back. It was a beautiful letter. He congratulated me on my letter-writing ability. He suggested that I get the hell out of the fur business and go writing letters for somebody. And he signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel from Amsel & Amsel in Montreal. P.S. Would you mind sending another telephone pole? And I share that with you because I know there's somebody sitting in this audience that owes $40. And he can't pay that $40 until he has the $40 because he's a big shot. Or there may be an Al-Anon gal that's afraid to admit to Simpson Sears that they can't pay that. They only have $38 and they have too much pride to go down and tell them that they can only pay $20 this month. Because that's the kind of a person I was. And if you were an alcoholic or afflicted with the illness of alcoholism, which you were, if you were around one, you too had that problem probably. And I went on to step two, where it said, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now they're telling me I'm crazy. And you know, I was quite a guy when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They used to say to me, pray, every morning. And I was a smart one, and I'd say, who to? They said, doesn't matter, just pray. So I prayed. They say at night, pray again, say thank you. And I'd say, who to? And they said, doesn't matter, just pray. And I was stupid enough to do that, and it worked. I stayed sober. And I would suggest if any of you are real smart and having a difficult time, get stupid. Because it works. And they said, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So I'd never been in a mental hospital, so I said, well, how can I come back from somewhere I haven't been? And they said, Cease, it's not the fact that you're insane, it's your insane thinking. It's your negative thinking. You know, I was something like the guy that got on the airplane, and he's sitting there, and he's laughing. The plane takes off, and he starts to laugh a little louder. And the fella's sitting beside him, and he's looking at him real strange. He wonders what's wrong. Finally, the guy that's laughing says, I really fixed this airline. So the guy gets thinking, well, by golly, maybe he planted a bomb or something. You know, I better ask him what he's done. And he says, well, what did you do? And he says, I bought a return ticket and I'm only going one way. You know. And I was a kind of a negative thinker like that. I was always going to fix them. I'll kill me, you know. And so these fellas told me that, see, you have a negative attitude. And they said, you're really a negative person. I was something like the barber. The fella said to slid into a barber chair one day, and he said, I'd like a haircut to last me for 3 weeks. And the barber says, why 3 weeks? And he said, I'm going on vacation. The barber said, where are you going? He said, first of all, I'm going to London, England. The barber says, you're not going to London, England. He says, I am. He said, you're not. He says, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. He says, never been there. He said, but I heard it's a lousy place to go. Too many people, too many cars. The guy said, look it, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going on over to Paris. The barber says, you're not going to Paris. He says, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. He says, they really fleece the tourists. Now, he says, I don't know. I've never been there. He said, but I heard it's a lousy place to go. The guy said, look, it just cut my hair. He said, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going on over to Rome. The barber said, you're not going to Rome. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. Too many Catholics there. The guy said, yeah, I don't care. He said, I'm a Catholic. Yeah, but the barber says, different kind of a Catholic over there. He says, no, I've never been there. He said, but I heard. The guy said, look, just get my hair cut done and let me get on my way. I want to go on my vacation. 3 weeks later, the guy comes back, slid into the barber's chair, and the barber says, how was your vacation? He said, it was good. He said, it wasn't. He said, it was. He says, you didn't go to London. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, you didn't like it. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, I'd love to stay longer, but I wanted to get on to Paris. He says, you didn't go to Paris. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, I'd love to stay there longer, but I wanted to get on to Rome. He says, you didn't go to Rome. And he says, I did. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. And he says, a great thing happened. He says, I got an audience with the Pope. And he says, you didn't. He says, you did. He says, you didn't. And he said, you'll never believe. He said, I knelt down and bent down to kiss the Pope's ring. And he says, you'll never believe what the Pope said. And the barber says, what? And he says, where the hell did you get that lousy haircut? So I was something like a barber. I had a negative thinking. I was a negative thinking man. But I found out that this second step could restore me to sane thinking or to positive thinking. And I went along with it. So in step one, I had an unmanageable life. Step two, I found a manager. And then they said I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand them. And now they're starting to talk about God. And then they're asking me to make a decision. I don't know whether you people, whether you're an Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, have any problems with decision. But I still have big problems with decision. Before coming up here today, I was trying to decide whether I should go to the bathroom or not. And right now, I don't know whether I've made the right decision or not. But I found out why people don't want to make decisions in Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon or Alateen. Did you ever get in one of these deals, you know, we're all lined up in these smorgasbord deals? It's not that it's tough, you know. It's that the Al-Anon people can't make a decision what they want. That's what holds the lineup up, you know. See that all of the time. But I realize that why people can't make decisions. We're afraid of making the wrong decision. Just recently, there was a wealthy fellow, probably from Toronto or somewhere. He was over in Ireland. And he's walking down the street, and suddenly somebody stuck a gun in his back. And he said, who are you? And the guy was a fast thinker, and he got thinking, well, my God, if I say I'm Protestant and the guy's Catholic, he'll shoot me. If I say I'm Catholic and he's Protestant, he'll shoot me. He says, I'm Jewish. The guy behind him says, I'm the luckiest Arab in the whole wide world. So you see, sometimes we can make the wrong decisions. And I think that's what I was afraid to do. But I'd found the fact that I had an unmanageable life, I found a manager, and in step three, I had to keep it as simple as this. Look it. I've done a lousy job of managing my life. How about you taking over? And that's how simple I had to keep it. And that may be strange to some of you people, and I really don't care. But to me, it made sense. Because I like to keep things simple. I don't like to complicate things. And I like to keep them simple enough so that I can understand them. Speaking of simplicity, I have a friend of mine that has a ranch out west. And another friend said to him, how did you name your ranch? Well, he said, I wanted to call it the Bar Q. My wife wanted to call it the Susie Q. My son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q. And my daughter wanted to call it the Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. The guy says, that's a hell of a name, but where are the cattle? He said, none of them ever survived the branding. I find out that I have to keep it simple or I may not survive the branding, you know. But that's the way it was with me. It's strictly a simple thing and a stupid thing, and I was stupid enough to do what they told me to do, and I did it. Thank God I did, because I stayed sober. But then they told me that I had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. Now they're asking me to stop taking your inventory and start taking mine. And they gave me a pencil and a paper. And they said, we know, Cease, that there's nothing wrong with you. But they said, go home and write it down. Nothing. And then they said, right underneath, write down that you're a liar. And you got something wrong with you. And I know that the fourth step, some people say it's a difficult step. It's in this book in page 65. It told me how to take it. And a lot of people have trouble with step four. I know this as I get around the country, and I don't care whether you're an Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you that it's probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me was to find out what was really wrong with me. And I don't think we can get fixed properly. And I don't think that I can get well. I don't know about you. But I don't think that I can get well properly unless I take a step four. Unless I find out what is wrong with me. And I don't think I can take an inventory without a pencil and a paper. I run a pretty successful business today. And if I was to phone home a couple of days ago and say I want an inventory of my stock when I get back, and when I got back, they say, well, I think we got so many minks, I think we got so many leathers, I think we got so many muskrats. That is not the kind of an inventory I want. I want an inventory that's written down. And I think this book of Alcoholics Anonymous wants an inventory that's written down. I don't think they want a mental inventory. As a matter of fact, it says get a pencil and a paper. So I imagine that they want a written inventory. And I got a written inventory. And I wrote down what was good with me and what was bad with me. And I found out I wasn't that bad, but I also found out I wasn't that good. And after taking my inventory, I found out that I had to admit to God, to myself and to another human being, the exact nature of my wrong. I found out that I'd taken 2/3 of step 5 by taking step 4. I also found out that there was only one thing difficult about step 5, and that was step 4. Because when I took step 4, I wanted to take step 5. And they say, well, who are you going to get to take it with? I found a little minister back home, and I went to him, and I was afraid that I'd shake him up a little bit by some of the things I had to tell him, but I didn't. Matter of fact, he shared a few things with me. He was a little bit of a orangutan himself. And he was looking for someone to talk to. Mind you, he's not in the ministry anymore. He joined the parole service right after that. But he's a good friend. But I took this step 5, and I'm really grateful that I took it. Because step 5, right after I took step 5, in this big book it told me, and it's the only step where it tells you what to do right after you've taken it. It tells you to take this book down from the shelf and read step 6 and 7. Where step 6 says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And that is a beautiful step. For you see, I admitted that I had an unmanageable life, and I found a manager, and I turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager, who I prefer to call God today. And then I took this inventory, and then I went and rapped off to another human being about how great I was or about how bad I was. And then I go to step 6. Our 12 by 12 tells us that this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Am I entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character? If you're like me, I was afraid of becoming too good too fast. Well, don't worry about that, because I don't think it'll happen. I'm privileged to be doing what I'm doing this afternoon practically every weekend somewhere. And I've never met a saint as yet in our fellowship. So we don't really have to worry about that. But it told me to be entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then they told me to humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And I know that a lot of people want to define what is the difference between shortcomings and defects of character. I don't think it really matters. The thing is that we've got them, and we have to get rid of them. And I don't think the fact that I become entirely ready, I don't think that they just take off just like that. I think I was never more ready after I finished step 5, immediately after I finished step 5, than I was when I finished it and I went to do step 6. And when it says humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings, the only way that I can be humble is by getting down on my knees. And I was a guy that couldn't get down on my knees. I'd been down on my knees at Sunday school, but I couldn't. I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just couldn't get down on my knees, and I wanted to. And I can remember when I was delegate to New York in 1957. And there was a fellow there by the name of Shy Walker from the Chicago area. And I can remember Shy talking one night at a meeting in New York. And I remember Shy telling us how he'd come out of a prison. And how he so much wanted to stay sober. And how he wanted to pray, and by getting down on his knees, and he just couldn't get down on his knees. And he told us one night how he came in and he was wearing high-top boots. He was working in construction work. And how he kicked his high-top boots underneath the bed. And he told us how the next morning when he got down on his knees to get his high-top boots, he decided that he should say a few words. And every night after that, he used to boot his boots under the bed so that the next morning he could get down and say a few words when he got his boots from under the bed. I don't know whether it works for high-top boots or not, but I do know one thing. It works for ordinary shoes because I tried it. I don't have to kick them under the bed anymore because I can get down on my knees whenever I want. Because I can pray when I want to, and thank God I can. And if there is any definition for me, for humility, it is the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. And that's what I found out by taking steps 6 and 7 in sequence. Step 8 told me that I had to make another list. I'd already made many of my list of the people I'd harmed in step 4, but it told me that I had to make another list of all the people I'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I made another list. For you see, I was stupid enough to do what they were asking me to do as we went through these steps in sequence. I found out another thing, that I was a very self-centered person, but I also found out as I went through the steps in sequence that it started to whittle me down to size. And if any of you say that this is not, you don't have to do this, this is true. You don't have to do anything in this beautiful program, but if you want what we have, it says here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. And I found out that I had to do all of those things. And then in step 9, it told me that I had to make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I went about making these amends. And you know, the toughest amend that I had to make was a lousy $3 amend. I was sitting in a beer parlor one day back home, the Broadway Beer Parlor. If anybody's ever been in Prince Albert, they'll know what a high-class place that is. And I was sitting there, and I didn't have any money. And a couple of fellas came in, and they were going to a hockey game, and they asked me to go with them. And I went with them. And they bought a 12-pack of beer. And when they got out to go to the hockey game, they said, "Lock the door, Cease." I got out and didn't lock the door. I lost them in the crowd, and I went back, and I stole a case of beer. I went down to the Army-Navy where I drank, and somebody stole it from me. And you should have heard me. Oh, my God. Called them a bunch of thieves. Just awful. The next day, I met the two guys that I'd gone to the hockey game with, and they said, "What happened to you last night?" And I said, "Well, I lost you in the crowd. I couldn't find you." And they said, "A strange thing happened." They said, "Our beer was stolen." I said, "Isn't it awful?" "Just like little Chicago or Detroit," I said. "Little town, 25,000-30,000 people. It's awful." So then they said, "Well, a stranger thing, though, the door was still locked." You see, I locked it after I stole the beer. And then I sobered up. And every time I went around a street corner, I met these two guys. One day, one of them came in a store I was working at, and he borrowed $10 from me. And one night, Babe and I were coming from a drive-in theater, and we went into the cafe. I went in to get her some cigarettes. And these two fellas were sitting there. And one called me over, and he said, "See, here's the $10 I owe you." And right then, we were working on that lousy step 9. And I said to myself, "Well, it's now or never." And I said, "How much is a case of beer, fellas?" And they said, "Don't worry about beer, Cease. We like you this way." And I said, "Yeah, but just how much is a case of beer?" They said, "Cease, don't worry about it. Stay the way you are." And I said, "Well, fellas, the night that we went to the hockey game, I was the guy that stole your beer. And I dropped $3 on the table." You may well wonder, "What's such a great deal about that?" He said he owed $6,200. Well, I'll tell you what's such a great deal about that. Right then and there, it whittled me a little bit more down to size. It took some more of that self-centeredness off me. But the biggest thing about it is that every time I used to meet these guys, I had a football in my stomach because I said, "Oh, my God, they know." The biggest thing about it is they still chum together in Prince Albert. They're still great friends. I still meet them coming around street corners. They still grin at me. But the biggest thing now is that I haven't got a football in my stomach, and I grin back. And that's what they promised me on page 83 of this big book. It made me some promises about step 9. It talked about freedom, and it talked about peace of mind. And it talked about being comfortable. And this is what I want in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can remember when I used to have to go down the main drag of my town. It's only a half a mile long. It used to be about 10 miles long. Because I'd start down on this side and I'd meet someone I couldn't meet and I'd have to go to this side. I'd meet someone there that I couldn't meet and I'd duck back here. Then someone would be coming from both ways and I'd have to go to a back alley. Hell, that's hard work. You know. Today I can walk down there and I can smile at the guys that I stole the beer from. Because I've cleaned my side of the street. And that's what they asked me to do in this beautiful book of Alcoholics Anonymous in step 9. Step 10 told me that I had to continue to take a personal inventory. And when I was wrong, promptly admitted it. And I wonder why they put step 10 exactly where it is. Because I think they knew that just about this time that some of us drunks may forget who we are and what we are and where we came from. And that's exactly what happened to me. I forgot who I was and what I was and where I came from. I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years. And I was working, I told you, for the wealthiest man in Prince Albert. And I decided he should be the second wealthiest man. And I set about and became very interested in those material things. And I got some of them. But in my great struggle to get them, I became once again spiritually poor. I never missed meetings. I went to meetings with attitudes something like this. And I'm telling you this because I hope it never happens to you, but it just may. You lucky people, here I am. And I don't care whether you're an Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, this can happen, because it happened to me. And then I would think if somebody, some of you would like some counseling after, I may be able to give you a couple of minutes of my time. One day that beautiful man that I was working for called me into his office. And it seems the store, and I was managing the largest ladies' wear store in Saskatchewan. And I was looking after the furs for 5 ladies' wear stores. And he called me into his office, and it seemed that the store wasn't quite big enough for the two of us. And it seemed that he wasn't about to leave. And he fired the great Cease Corrigal. And I walked out of that store with an attitude something like this. They won't last long now. That's after 10 years of sobriety. And I tell you this because in this book it tells us we've been granted a one-day reprieve. And let's never forget it. Because it happened to me, folks. And I had a little cousin that came from the West Coast, and she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came to visit me. And she arrived in Prince Albert, and I didn't have a job. And I was going to a roundup in Flin Flon, Manitoba. And I went downtown, and I bought some brand new clothes. And I went down to see my little cousin to say goodbye to her. And I stood up in front of her in my big egotistical way and I said, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And she said these few simple words to me and I'm going to share them with you. She said, "You look real good on the outside, Cease. How are you really on the inside?" And I went to Flin Flon, Manitoba with a dear old fella by the name of Dave Murray, who's now passed away. And I drove Dave's car. And Dave didn't talk to me because he thought maybe something was happening to me. And it was. After the roundup in Flin Flon, I went into Manitoba, into Winnipeg, Manitoba. And I spent a couple of days in a hotel room just talking to God, deciding what I was going to do with my future. I went back to Prince Albert and I went in business for myself, and that's really not important. I had to do something. But the important thing is I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had never missed a meeting. But I went back with the right attitude and the right motive. I went back to do institutional work with the right attitude and the right motive. All because that little gal said those great words to me. Step 11 tells me to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. The very fact that I can say that is a miracle. The fact that I know what it means is a bigger miracle. The fact today that I know what prayer means to me. Prayer is just talking to God as far as I'm concerned. A communication with a loving God as I understand Him. Meditation to me is shutting my big mouth and listening for answers. And I have a beautiful room in my home back home. And every morning, I have to go into this room. And I have to read. And I have to study step 11. And I take out this big book. And I read page 86 and I read page 87. I read the prayer on page 63. And I read the prayer on page 76. And I read the last couple of paragraphs on page 164 of A Vision for You. You may wonder why I have to do that. I'll tell you why I have to do that. Not too many years ago, I found myself on the way to work having an argument with a guy. The guy was in Vancouver and I was in Prince Albert. And I was having an argument with out loud. And that's a hard thing to do because you got to figure out what he's saying and he's not even there. And I got to my store and I wasn't finished arguing and I drove around the block a couple of times. And I got to work 8:45 in the morning completely exhausted. I don't want to live that way. I want to live so that I can be free each and every day and to walk comfortably in sobriety. And that's the reason that I have to go into that little room every morning. Sometimes it's not in my home. Sometimes it's many, many places where I may be. But I have this book and some other books that I have to read. Some of you may say, well, that's a lot of effort. You can't get up that early. I'll tell you, I have to get up that early. Because when I walk into my store before my staff arrives there, I greet them the same way as I want them to greet the customer. And I run a pretty successful operation. And I have a staff that work with me and not for me. And they allow me to be away practically every weekend somewhere because of this beautiful program. And I got a story that I must tell. Sometimes when I'm down east, my daughter lives in Newcastle. She has a little daughter that's 5 years old, and they're with me today. Sometimes when I come to visit them, my little granddaughter has her suitcase packed and she's going to come home with me. And sometimes she comes home with me, because I think that's what granddaddies are for, to spoil granddaughter. And one time when she came home with me, first morning she was home, I was in my room doing my reading. And she knocked on my door. And Babe says, you can't go in there, honey. Gramps is doing his reading. And she said, well, I have something to tell him. And I said, well, let her come in. And she came in. And I took her up on my knee. And I explained to her what I was doing. And then I said, well, what did you want to tell me, honey? She said, I just wanted to tell you that I love you. And I said, I want you to know that I love you too. That may not mean a thing to any few people. But to me, the great I Am that came to this program where I couldn't accept love and I couldn't give it back, it means a great deal to me. And today, when she arrived, I said, I love you, honey. And she says, I love you too. And it was beautiful. Step 12 tells me, it says, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic that still suffers and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps. What is a spiritual awakening? To me, it's just a personality change. The fact that I can be in Toronto today, 2,000 miles away from home, loving every one of you people, not expecting anything in return as far as money goes. For you see, I was the type of a guy that never did anything for anybody unless I expected something for it. The fact that I can go to prisons, the fact that I can go to 12-step work, not thinking of myself, but thinking of the other person, is a personality change. The fact that I can listen to somebody tell me their troubles when they need somebody to listen to them is a personality change. And it says, having had a spiritual awakening. I once heard a story about
this great actor. And he was asked to say the 23rd Psalm, and Tom talked so beautiful about it last night. And he was asked to say the 23rd Psalm at this big deal they were having. And he went home and he rehearsed it. Rehearsed it on a tape recorder, and he rehearsed it in front of the mirror as any great actor would do. And the Sunday before he was supposed to say it, he went to church. And his minister said the 23rd Psalm. And finally the great night arrived, and this great actor stood up in front of these thousands of people. And he said the 23rd Psalm the way that any great actor could say it. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And when he was all finished, he got a standing ovation. And he walked back up to the microphone and he said, I would like to ask a favor of you people. He said, I have a minister friend in the audience. And he said, I would like him to come up here and say the 23rd Psalm. His minister friend came up and said the 23rd Psalm the way it's supposed to be said, from the heart and not from the mouth. And when it was all over, there was no standing ovation. There was a lot of tears in a lot of people's eyes. And the great actor once again went up to the microphone and he said, you see, the difference between my minister friend and I is that I know the sheep, but he knows the shepherd. And we in Alcoholics Anonymous are privileged to know both. And isn't it beautiful? And then it says we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. You know, there's a lot of people in this room today who are suffering. You've got that football in your stomach. You could be an Al-Anon, or you could be an Alateen, or you could be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can promise you one thing. If you take those steps in sequence, you can get rid of that football, and you can find that freedom. And there's a lot of people here who have a lot of sobriety, and you have good sobriety. And you get the opportunity to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. Well, this afternoon, remember that that alcoholic or somebody that may be suffering may be sitting right beside you. When this meeting is over, shake hands with somebody beside you and tell them that they love you, that you love them. Because that's what they told me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that they may be suffering. And don't be like the alcoholic that I once heard about. He got up one morning and he got mad at his wife. And he slammed the door and he went and jumped in his car. And he drove to work, and he was in other people's lanes, and when somebody else got in his lane, he was honking the horn, and he would get to a stop sign. The red light would be on. The minute it would turn green, he would blow the horn, and away they'd go. And he got to work, and he treated everybody at work the same way. He got in his car at night, and he drove home the same way. He got home, and he was still mad at his wife. The kids were watching television. He said, turn the television off. I want to read the paper. They turned the television off, and he fell asleep. The phone rang. And it was some poor alcoholic wanting help. And this fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, my God, why should he phone tonight? And he went out and he jumped in his car and he drove the same way again, swearing at people, cursing at people, telling people to get out of his way. And he arrived at this place where he was going to do this 12-step call. And he went in and here's this poor drunk laying there on the bed dying. And you know what this member of Alcoholics Anonymous said to him? If you want what we have. Who in the hell would want that? If we're going on a 12-step call, let's go with a smile on our face, not with our chin on our navel. And it says to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank God today I have some principles. Live and let live. Keep an open mind. There's beautiful slogans that I saw in the club rooms when I arrived. The serenity prayer. The beautiful principles that I learned in Our Father. All of those principles that we've got. You know, and we've had a beautiful weekend. And it's been easy to practice the principles. But this afternoon, we have to get out of here. In a little while, we have to get out of this hotel. What's going to happen when we get down in that lineup? What's going to happen when we get riding that freeway on our way home? And suddenly, your sweet little Al-Anon wife says, Oh, my God, I forgot my suitcase. That's when we practice the principle. And we drive back to get the suitcase. And we're trying to make up time, and we're going 70 miles an hour, and we get picked up by the police. And you look at that sweet little Al-Anon woman. And you say, if you hadn't forgot that suitcase. Just before you get home, 2 miles from home, you run out of gas. That's when you practice the principle. That's the principles I believe they're talking about. I once heard of this sweet little Al-Anon gal. I think she was from this area because she had a lot of money. And she couldn't get her old husband sobered up nohow. And she decided to take him on a trip. And she took him to Europe, and he was drunk when they got on the plane. He got drunker on the plane, and he got drunker when they got over there. And they went out for a walk. And they came to one of these big wishing wells. And they stood on there and they threw their money in. And this poor alcoholic was so drunk he fell in and he drowned. And you know what that sweet little Al-Anon gal said? Holy hell, this thing really works. I don't think that's practicing the principle. I want to thank the committee for giving me this very pleasurable privilege of being with you this weekend. And I want you to know that I'm leaving here a much wealthier man than when I came, because I've got a whole bucket full of AA. And I want to tell each and every one of you that I love you. And that's a great thing for me to say. And I want to wish every one of you happy sobriety, happy Al-Anon, and happy Al-Ateen. And I want to finish with this story. It's about a young member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was talking to an older member. And he said to the older member, he said, you know, I'm going to quit. And the older member said to him, why are you going to quit? And he says, well, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me it wasn't going to cost me any money. They told me I didn't have to do anything. And he says, now they want me to go to conferences. They want me to go to hospitals and sit with people. They want me to go to prisons and talk to people in prison. They want me to do 12-step work. They want me to throw money into the pot for birthday cakes. They want me to throw money into the pot to pay central office. They want me to throw money into the pot to pay general service office. And he said, I'm getting sick and tired of it, and I'm going to quit. And the old member sat there for a moment in his easy does it way. And then he says, you know, son, I don't blame you a bit. Because he says, your story reminds me of the story of my life. He said, when I was very young, my wife and I were blessed with a bouncing baby boy. And he said, somebody told us that three could live as cheap as two. But the moment that child was born, he started to cost me money. I had to take the baby home because the wife couldn't go home from the hospital. I had to hire people to look after her, and I had to hire people to look after him. Every time I went downtown, it cost me money. Finally, he started to creep around, and they wanted toys for the kid. Finally, he started to ride a tricycle. I had to buy him a tricycle. Suddenly, he went into public school, and there he needed a bicycle. A tricycle wasn't big enough. He needed a lot of things, and I had to buy them for him. And then he went into high school, he said, and he really started to cost me money. Extra money to take the girls out. The bicycle wasn't good enough. He needed a motorcycle. Finally, he needed an old car. Extra money to go away to summer school. Extra money for sporting goods equipment. And he said, and I was like you. I was getting sick and tired of it, and I felt like quitting. But then he said, in the final year of high school, that boy of ours died, and he hasn't cost me a penny since. Do what you like with that story, folks. But let's remember to keep Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen alive. And I want to close this talk the way that I close every talk that I ever give. And I only hope that it helps you as much as it helped me. Every one of you look real good on the outside today. How are you really on the inside? Thank you, God bless you.